Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
It is 12:11 here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Happy Thursday afternoon, and a happy Thursday afternoon to Dennis Rodkin from Crane Chicago Business in the studio.
Hi, Steve.
How are you?
Good.
All right, so let's talk about dismal home situations in the city. The holiday's just around the corner.
Yeah, I'm now, here to bring some gloom.
Well, you know, okay, let's do something happy news first. I talked to Bill and Wendy about the fact that Dick Portillo, you know, just 30 seconds here.
There you go.
Sold Portillo's not long ago, and so he's flipping houses.
He's flipping houses.
Is this
in
for
Hinsdale?
An HGTV show? Or?
I think it's, well, did you see the picture of the one he did?
It
belongs on HGTV. It's a nice house from the 20s. Got involved with his daughter-in-law, as they explained it to me. She's an empty nester with some design ability. He's a man with some money. And they decided he would buy houses and she would rehab them and flip them.
Have fun.
Yeah, I think it works real well. And they sold that one for $3.8 million. So this is, you know, this is not the let's buy the $50,000 condo and flip it for $90,000. This is they bought this one for about $1 million, I think $1.9 million. Really great old house in Hinsdale, but mm-hmm. you know, tired, as he said, needed some work, and they just gave it a whole lot of sizzle and resold it.
I just like the fact that he's like, yeah, I got some cash,
yeah,
and she's got the eye for it, so
let's do it.
All right, so
they've only done a few.
Well, but they don't really need to do any, right? So it's
probably
all
not.
For fun.
Probably not.
Let's talk about the fact that the Chicago market, it seems, is really lagging the rest of the country when it comes to this recovery. What is it? Is it 20% of the U.S. or Illinois area homes are still underwater? Is it 20%?
Yeah, 1 out of 5, which is an improvement. A year ago, it was 1 out of 4. A year ago, it was about 25%. Now, in the third quarter of 2015, according to Realty Track, it was down to 20% or a little over 20%. So that's improvement.
Right, but it still means that 1 out of 5 of us who are homeowners.
Right. 1 out of 5 of us who are homeowners owe more on our mortgage than the house is worth. And that's considerably higher than the national figure. And it's also among the 35 cities that they study, it's the second worst. Las Vegas is the only one worse. And I think it's worth mentioning, we moved either up or down a position, depending on how you want to look at it. We moved closer to the bottom in the course of the past year. Year ago, we were third from the bottom with Atlanta and Vegas behind us, now only Vegas. And I think that's worth pointing out because everybody's healing, but there are a lot of cities, including Atlanta, healing faster than we are.
And so what would speed, what, well, first of all, what slows it, I guess?
Our market has continued to struggle since the beginning. We had a much higher foreclosure rate. We had a slower process of reselling foreclosures. We also, as you know, have an enormously high property tax burden. We've been losing population, so demand for houses is sliding. And there are 3 or 4 others, if we had an hour, we could go into. But in general, our market just keeps limping along. We're winged. There are, in that same study, they're talking about cities where being underwater is now an old thing. You know, it's something from the
remember back in the day.
Yeah, remember during the bust? That was awful, but it isn't a problem now. But for cities like Chicago, especially like Chicago, Las Vegas, Atlanta, and several others, it's still a problem.
Well, it seems like a home purchasing is emotional in many ways, right?
Right.
And so I'm just wondering, Chicago's been going through some rough sort of reputation fights over the past year or two. I don't know if that would have an impact or not, because most of the homes sold, I think, in the market are from buyers who are still in the market, right? It's not keeping other people from coming here.
It's, well, see, that's the thing. It is primarily trading within the market, but because we're losing population, because we have a lot of people who've left either because of job transfers, because of weather, or because of our tax burden, demand is shrinking for an existing pool of houses.
I suppose then it only follows that Chicago home prices are growing very slowly when compared to the rest of the country.
Very slowly, yeah. And this, too, has been true for quite a while. We had a nice run-up in 2013, early 14. Prices were really starting to pop, but they have slowed down. Prices are still growing, but they're growing at only about 2% a year in Chicago, which is lower than inflation. I'm sorry, which is still better than inflation. But in some cities, prices have been in San Francisco, in Denver, in those two and others. Prices are up over 10% in the course of a year.
In prices are up 10%.
Exactly. When we're up 2 or less.
All right, Dennis, you're the expert. I'm not sure I heard you give me a solution to this yet.
One solution is for us to rebuild our financial standing, our state's financial standing, right? One thing is
okay,
to,
that's easily done. Right? What's two?
Well, cut property taxes. Our property taxes are very high. But another would be to give some reason for people to move, you know, to come into the community. We're bringing a few hundred people in with ConAgra. Those kinds of things happen. We bring some number of people in, but a lot of the tech people who come in to work for Google and places like that rent because they're young professionals who think I'm only going to be here for a few years, right? So I can't sell at a profit, so I'll just rent. Where it used to be during just 10 years ago, if you moved to Chicago early in your career, you were young and you didn't know how long you'd be here, you'd buy because you knew you could flip it. That was true of the professional athletes. I think you and I have discussed this. The pro athletes, when they came to Chicago, would buy these fabulous places.
Because they knew they'd get rid of them in a couple of years.
Yeah, and now a lot of them sit on the market, so a lot of the athletes rent.
I remember when dads had kids graduating from high school or college buying condos and houses for them.
Exactly, right. And it's just it's like a self-fulfilling cycle. Our values aren't increasing fast enough to make it look profitable, so fewer people buy, so our values increase less fast.
All right, let's end in a happy place.
Let's try.
Let's go to Morgan Park.
Yeah, where prices and sales are up. It's
Along Western Avenue, right?
Along Western in the 105 to 115, well, it starts at 107th officially, down to 115th or so, both sides, south of Beverly, east of Mount Greenwood, in that sort of, I call it the Holy Trinity of the Southwest side, Morgan Park, Beverly, and Mount Greenwood. They're all relatively similar. Morgan Park is, of those three, when you chop them up real estate-wise, the cheapest of the three. And prices have been going up pretty well. Sales have been popping, 37% more sales by the end of October than the previous year. And that's better than Beverly, Mount Greenwood, and also better than almost any other place on the south side, where and many neighborhoods in the north side. And then they're also selling really quickly. One of the measures of a healthy market is how fast houses are selling. While the citywide figure is about 93 days year to date, in Morgan Park, it's in the 50s. It's like 56 days for a house to sell. And that's great.
Dennis Rodkin, Crane Chicago Business. What's your Twitter handle?
Dennis Rodkin.
Oh, people can follow you. Dennis, it's an underscore, right? Dennis
Dennis Rodkin. Right, exactly.
All right, read more there. Follow Dennis Rodkin. Nice to see you again.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand here on this Thursday afternoon. Follow me on Twitter, if you would. It's at Steve Bertrand, or on Facebook at Steve Bertrand. Also a page, Steve Bertrand on Books. Bill Geiger is here. You should probably be subscribing to his blog as well, Chicago's retirement planning expert and a Fortune.com contributor. And he has a bit of a tan this afternoon. Bill, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, sir.
After
nice to be back.
A very relaxing period in Florida, giving thanks and cooking out and enjoying the warm weather.
On our new grill with our new granddaughter, life is good.
Yeah, you were gone and the rest of us broke out our snowblowers, just so you know.
But I told you the problem we had.
What's the problem?
The pool was just a little too warm.
Yeah, I already blanked that out. We're here and we talk with you every week about retirement. And, we come toward the end of the year and people are probably looking at 401k levels and things like that. What's sort of the biggest hurdle that people face when it comes to the retirement?
Well, I'll tell you the three big questions that come up to us most frequently when people come in from the show or from referrals is one is, how am I going to pay my bills every month when I retire? Where am I going to get that income from? Mm-hmm. The second is how can I stay up with inflation, which might have to last 20 to 30 years? And the third is, how do I make sure that I don't run out of money? In other words, that my money lasts me.
So you got to, in a way, and this is what I struggle with all the time, because I don't think there's a definitive answer, but you got to figure out how much things are going to cost when you don't know how much they're going to cost.
Well, that's why you split your portfolio into two pieces. Part of your portfolio is oriented toward income. That answers the question of, how do I pay my bills?
Okay.
Okay. But the other part of your portfolio is a growth portion, and that's how you stay up with inflation over time. Now the growth portion for a pre-retiree, people who are 55 to 65 years old, is much different than traditionally what you think of as a growth portfolio. If you're 30 years old, you're thinking about growth, growth, growth.
Right.
Okay. If you're 59, 60, 62, you need to think first protection and then growth, growth, growth. See, you want to hang on to what you have because you don't have 20 years to make it back up again.
But you got to figure out when you go into the protection mode. It's not always just a year, is it?
Yeah. Listen, if you're 5 to 10 years from retirement, you better be having serious thoughts about starting to protect.
Right. I'm considering myself only a year from retirement, but yeah, I still have to
at any one time, right?
I got to go buy that lottery ticket. So if you're 5 to 10, that's when you start to move into protection?
Yeah, and especially now. I've been nervous about this market for the last couple of years, and it continues to go up. But if you're in that red zone, if you will, 5 to 10 years from retirement, and we're having this type of stock market going on, this is all the more reason to really think about how do you protect yourself.
Right. What is the how do we make sure that we don't sort of outlive the nest egg?
Ironically, the biggest deal is not having big losses. You know, we think about, well, we need a lot of growth, right? Stay away from big losses, and a monkey could manage your portfolio in an up market.
Right.
It's keeping from having those big losses in a down market that's critical.
Okay, but there's got to be a balance, right? Because you could protect from big losses by putting your money in a savings account, and that's not going to do you much.
No, that's not the way you do it. You're using index funds. You're managing them to be defensive.
Right. Do you think people are becoming more or less educated when it comes to their retirement?
I think they're becoming more educated. The internet's an amazing thing, but it's become too amazing of a thing. There's too much information.
Right.
And basically what you need, instead of just 1,000 pieces of information, you need a plan. You need a game plan for going into retirement. It doesn't mean looking at Vanguard's website for some popular reading. It means actually sitting down and putting a plan together.
Well, I just think, you know, I think it's going to be a crisis this country's going to face because we're moving from the fixed pension retirees,
right,
into people who've had to have more responsibility for their own. And if you don't take that responsibility, there's going to be trouble.
Well, even if you do, how do you suddenly become a pension manager? Right?
Right, exactly.
I mean, you really do.
I was
really
a T-ball manager once. Bill, it didn't work very well.
No? Okay. You really do need help with this stuff. It's too serious a thing to try to do it yourself.
And that's the sort of thing you can do, right?
That's what we do.
All right. Thanks, Bill. Nice to see you again.
Good to see you.
Remember, you can sign up for Bill's weekly retirement planning blog at growmyretirement.com. How long will your portfolio last? Well, Bill Geiger, Chicago's retirement planning expert, can help you answer this question and offer solutions to make sure you don't outlive your money. Geiger Wealth is making a special offer for the next 5 callers at 800-681-2498. Geiger Wealth will sit with you to do a full-blown financial plan. It's complimentary with no obligation to the next 5 callers with at least $500,000 saved for retirement. You'll learn how much risk is in your portfolio, how much income you can realistically expect to have in retirement, and maybe most importantly, how well does your portfolio match up with what you're really trying to accomplish? Give them a call, 800-681-2498, and sit with Geiger Wealth Management to create your complimentary financial plan. It's a $3,000 value. Geiger Wealth will translate the complex financial planning process into easy-to-understand instructions. Call Geiger Wealth at 800-681-2498. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. You know, tomorrow we get the jobs report for November. That will be announced. But today, Challenger, Gray, and Christmas came out with their annual sort of job, not annual, but monthly job cut report. I was surprised to read in it that 2015 is shaping up to be the year with the biggest number of job cuts since 2009. That comes as we hear about all of these new jobs being created. Well, we will talk more about that later this half hour with Andrew Challenger, Vice President at Challenger Gray and Christmas. Right now, we talk to Ian Scherer from CNET about Barbie, Mark Zuckerberg, and Adobe, all of those things wrapped into one. Ian, welcome to the Business Lunch. Let's start with the with wedding gifts, right? I guess probably Mark Zuckerberg doesn't need a wedding gift, but if we give him something, he's just going to give it away anyway.
Well, yes, there's that. So it's actually a baby gift if you want to think about it.
I'm
so
sorry,
Mark Zuckerberg,
that's right.
Who's, yeah, he's the CEO of Facebook, right? And he announced the birth of his child, his first child, just earlier this week. He and his wife, Priscilla Chan. And as part of that announcement, they also said that they were going to create a new, what they call an initiative, they call the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, where they're going to basically give 99% of Zuckerberg's Facebook shares, which is about $45 billion with a B, to this initiative to try and fund all sorts of philanthropic efforts, such as, you know, reforming education, helping with health, helping with internet access around the world, and all sorts of stuff. They wrote a 2,200-word manifesto on Zuckerberg's Facebook page, which was also kind of a letter to their daughter. And it's really interesting just kind of to see, you know, if you think about the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which is obviously named after the co-founder of Microsoft and one of the richest men in the world, they had $44.3 billion in assets last year. So we're basically doubling the Gates Foundation, if you think about it. And what's interesting also is that Zuckerberg is creating this thing as a different type of entity where he's able to actually receive profits from the efforts and then reinvest them back into the initiatives that they want to. So it's going to be really fascinating to watch him do all this stuff.
I'm thinking of poor Max Zuckerberg. She's on the planet for less than a day and she loses 99% of her inheritance.
Well, the good news is that according to Forbes's real-time tracker of wealth, it says that Zuckerberg's worth about $46.8 billion right now. So Max will at least have an extra billion sitting around when the time comes.
She's not going to have to worry about her FAFSA form.
No, I think she'll be fine.
All right, so I'm interested in this idea, though, that we are sort of coming upon this new American class of the great sort of charitable givers. I can't think of it. Philanthropers is the word I'm trying to find. That we kind of had in the 19th century. Here we are in the 21st, and we've got this sort of new class of people giving away their wealth.
It's fascinating, really. And if you look at it, a lot of it has actually been touched off by, well, at least this most recent round was touched off by people like Warren Buffett, who got involved in the Giving Pledge, which, if you remember that from 6 or so years ago,
right. It
was about giving away at least half your wealth, right? Which, again, we're talking about people with billions of dollars. So this is a meaningful amount of money. But what's really fascinating, I think, is when you look at all of this stuff, that it's very hard to target your money to actually succeed at something. If you look at the International Monetary Fund or the UN, they struggle enough on their own to really make this stuff matter and to get the money to the right places and then to have really big impact. And, you know, now you have people who are basically coding experts, right? And, you know, people who are titans of industry who are trying to go in and make a difference in this world that professionals have troubles with. So it's going to be really fascinating to see whether or not they can succeed. On Mark Zuckerberg alone, you know, he tried to get involved in New Jersey schools to the tune of some $100 million, and it's been widely panned and criticized.
I remember
that. He changed his methods when he came to California and did it this way for a California school system. But it's still like it's going to be tough. And what's interesting is that his ideas are very ambitious. If you read that manifesto he wrote, it's really like he is trying to change the world. He wants to make the world a better place for his daughter, which no one's going to begrudge him that. But whether or not he can succeed at those things, at the very high-minded ideals, it's going to be really fascinating to see.
He is a modern-day titan. He and Gates and Buffett and others. And it's I love watching it. I hope it all works out for all of us. All right, gift giving. I know there's computerized Barbie and all these new computerized toys. And there was a piece in CNET recently by Laura Hautala. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Hautala.
Yeah. Okay. About how, you know, they're not paying enough attention to the security for these toys.
Yeah, that's the real concern. I mean, if you think of the song that says Santa Claus sees you when you're sleeping and knows when you're awake, is he the only one, right?
I'm thinking of the Elf on the Shelf.
The Elf on the Shelf as well, right? And that's the interesting thing is that as we're including technology more and more in toys, and that's the underlying thing here, is that a lot of these companies are not technology experts. You think about the trouble that Apple and Google and Facebook and Microsoft all go through to make sure their stuff is secure, and they have struggles. Now you have toy companies who are not technology experts getting involved, and of course you're going to see problems. And we've just in the last couple of weeks, we've seen some massive problems. Like there's this company called VTech, right, that had a thing called the Learning Lodge where, you know, they're able to have kids and parents kind of do learning exercises together and use their toys that are very popular to learn. They had a huge hack that affected more than 6.3 million people, including children.
All right, so if you've got a three-year-old playing with this, why does a hacker want to get in?
Well, that's part of the problem is that right now we're not entirely sure how the hackers would use this information, right? But what we do know is that hackers tend to try and gather as much information as they can to build profiles of people. And if the more they know about you, the easier it is to hack you. Because, for example, a lot of us use really bad passwords, and we use the same password everywhere we go. So if I now know your child's name, I'm able to use that as one of the tests to see whether or not that's one of your passwords, right? And at the end of the day, they all want to make money, right? They all want to be able to get money out of your account and put it in theirs. And so the easiest way to do that is to build a profile of who you are. If you think of what happened during the celebrity hacking scandal that happened earlier this year, where you had a number of celebrities, you know, some kind of salacious photos got out and all of that, right? Their accounts were not hacked. The hackers actually just figured out what their security passwords were and figured out what their kind of recovery stuff was, like what's your mother's maiden name. Well, nobody knows my mother's maiden name, but a lot of people know what Taylor Swift's mother's maiden name is, right? So it's those types of things that are really dangerous when they're able to build a profile and figure out who you are.
What is your mother's?
That's why we should worry about these hacking of children's toys, because we're learning about, now they're learning about our children, not to mention being able to watch them.
What is your mother's maiden name, Ian?
I'm not going to tell you. What are you talking about?
let's kick around this Adobe thing, too, because Adobe made an announcement this week, and they killed Adobe Flash. It is dead and gone forever. Wait, that's not quite right.
Yeah, that's exactly not quite right. So, you know, first off, Adobe Flash, will be clear, is this technology that got very popular in the 90s and basically made it easy to do animation on the web, right? And a lot of us, when you first were encountering video on the internet, you probably were using Adobe Flash. And one of the things about it is that it's great technology for animation, but it's very old at this point, and it sucks down battery life. It's not very efficient. And there have been a lot of other technologies that have come along that are a lot better for this type of thing. And so the industry has been slowly kind of getting itself out of Flash, but it's very hard because people have been trained to use it. There's a lot of websites that still use it. And even now, it's just really hard to get it out. So what's interesting is that Adobe itself has started making moves that look like they're getting rid of it, right? And one of the biggest moves was they actually renamed Flash. They did this just on Monday. They renamed it Animate, which is, you know, when you dump such a popular brand, everyone knows Flash. It says something, right? It's kind of this is like the 20th nail in the coffin toward this thing.
Right.
And we've already seen other things, right? They stopped allowing Flash in the iPhone and the iPad and all that stuff. That happened many years ago. But this is now Adobe admitting in many ways that it's going away.
Ian Schur from CNET. Listen, thanks very much for talking to us this week. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
12:45, you're listening to The Business Lunch on WGN. It's 12:52. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Few minutes left. You know, the numbers came out today. The U.S.-based employers fell, the number of layoffs by U.S. bosses fell to the lowest level in 14 months. That's the good news. The bad news, maybe not so good, is that it looks like 2015 will be the year with the most layoffs since, I think, it's 2009. Those numbers come from Challenger, Gray & Christmas. Andrew Challenger is a vice president at the Chicago firm, and he joins us on a phone line now. Andrew, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, so how about these numbers? I guess it's good that the number of job cuts in February and November down, I think the most since September of 2014. But as a year altogether, a year as a whole, we seem to have quite a number of job cuts.
Yeah, so after a four-month stretch where we saw more than a quarter of a million jobs cuts announced by U.S.-based firms, in November it fell to the lowest level of cuts that we've seen this entire year.
But when we come into December, isn't December, I always think of it as, you know, maybe it just gets more play, but December is the time of year when a lot of companies cut their workforce. They're trying to, you know, look at their revenues and things like that, their projections, and it's right before the holidays. A lot of people get fired. Are we expecting that in December?
Yeah, particularly because we've seen such a slow month for announcements in November. We can probably expect the end of the year to pick up even more. We're on pace in 2015 to have the highest number of cuts overall, with U.S. employers announcing 574,888 job cuts that we've seen since the heat of the recession in 2009.
But Andrew, yesterday, you know, we got the figures from ADP, the job numbers. They look good. We expect good numbers from the federal government in the November jobs report tomorrow. Why is it that there are so many layoffs?
Yeah, so that's kind of the interesting component, is that really what it amounts to is volatility. Some industries are contracting while others are expanding, because at the end of the day, 2 million more people are employed this year than the same time last year.
So even though there are cuts, we're still coming out a net plus for the year.
Yeah, with unemployment at 5%, there's really not that much farther we can go down. And overall, from a labor perspective, the economy is in really good shape.
All right. So we always like to talk about how bad things are in Illinois. We might as well give that a shake right now. You look at it by region, the number of layoffs year to date, looks like Texas leads the country with 105,000. Then comes California, the District of Columbia. And after that, Illinois with 32,000 job cuts for the year. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, so in Texas by far led the way, because in the beginning of the year, and you saw it in a lot of headlines, the energy sector and oil have been slashing in a way that we haven't seen in a long time. Overall, the energy sector's layoffs are up 700% from last year.
And Illinois, is there a particular source of the job cuts here, or is it pretty much just spread across the board?
In Illinois, it's been, you know, primarily heavy manufacturing and industrial goods. So more in the southern part of the state, companies like Caterpillar.
All right, I want to ask you one more question here, because there's a chart with the report from Challenger Grain Christmas today that talks about the reasons for the job cuts. Number one is restructuring. Year to date, 184,000 people have lost their jobs to restructuring. But some of the other causes are cost cutting, closing, demand downturn, and such. So restructuring, what is that? Is that are those mergers, or what does that mean, restructuring?
Yeah, exactly. So in a lot of cases, that restructuring happens after two large companies merge. And the reason, you know, companies merge all the time is because there's going to be redundancies in their labor force. And so inevitably, when you see big mergers like we've seen Kraft Heinz in Chicago, we've seen Walgreens and Boots merge, and that ends up equating to layoffs.
All right, I like that. I don't like it, but the number 184,000 job losses this year to restructuring, as compared to bird flu, which you look at, only 382 people lost their jobs this year because of bird flu. So we got that to thank ourselves for. Andrew Challenger, Nice to talk to you. Thanks very much for joining us on the Business Lunch today.
Appreciate it. Nice speaking with you, too.